Welcome to the Humans in AI podcast, powered by AI Frontier Network. I'm your host, Flor Laorga. Each episode, we dive into the human story shaping artificial intelligence through the journeys of entrepreneurs, builders, and leaders. We explore the insights, challenges, and visions for the future of AI and humanity. Let's uncover the human side of AI together. Hi, Samita. Thanks very much to join to our Humans in AI podcast. It's hosted by AI Frontier Network, by myself, Flor. Yeah, so I appreciate a lot the invitation to join this podcast while you are in the first line of the guests. So I appreciate your trust. Let's start.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. And thanks for having me, actually. Yeah.
Thank you. Let's start from the beginning as this is a kind of human side of the AI and of your professional career, which obviously is very important, but we want to focus more in that field, which is the human side.
Sure.
So I would like you to, well, I've read your story and I found it very impressive, very interested. You have a very interesting background. Like you were born in
Sri Lanka.
You were born in the early 80s. So be connected since so early age with computers and software in Sri Lanka, what was that experience for you, like in such a early age in your life? What did develop in your, like, that was the main point for you, like you get so fascinated by technology, for example?
Sure. So as you correctly said, I was born in the early 80s, and then at that time, Sri Lanka didn't have this technical boom. There were no computers in the household or even in offices at that time. People rarely heard of a computer at that time, even. So I got connected with computers when I got an opportunity. I think I was in kindergarten or maybe grade one. I got to visit my father's office. At that time, it was having one of the mainframes in Sri Lanka. I think they had like a handful at that time in Sri Lanka. So I was lucky to kind of visit an office which actually had a mainframe. So it's not like a personal computer or laptop that we see these days. It's like a huge room filled with machines from this end to that with a couple of monitors. So it was this huge, fantastic thing that kind of caught my eye. And obviously, I mean, I was not allowed to touch or play with it, but the sight itself was so strong, it kind of had an impression on me. So from there onwards, I was really curious. I was asking questions from everyone I can meet in the office. So I was able to read a couple of manuals. I didn't really understood it, but I was able to kind of read some basic stuff on it. And of course, my father explained certain things to me that kind of made me really curious about what these machines could do. And at that time, they were using it for all, I think, accounting work, pretty much things like that. So that interaction, and I was told that they were able to kind of share with all the physical work and the files that they were able to throw away because of this mechanical thing. So from there onwards, I was like really curious about it, and I keep on pursuing on that. And I was able to convince my parents to buy a computer like when I was in my old age. Like, you know, that's the first time I got my hand. And yeah, that's my path into being curious in the technical world.
I find that impressive, you know, because, well, like, it's kind of like it meant to be for you to do software and technology and these kind of things, you know, like you've got it very absorbed since a kid. So I found it so interesting. How do you find yourself, like, well, you get into tech leadership at very early age, even before graduation, you know, by graduating. So what do you think that this is for? Like, do you think it was, well, you said already you are a very curious person from that, but do you think it was a lack, or you kind of worked very hard to get into it? What was the motivation behind?
Right. Actually, there's a story behind how I got into leadership. Of course, I started my higher education in development as a software engineer. I was going through university. And I did a little bit of freelancing work as well at that time, just to, you know, earn a little bit of extra money, which really helped my education and maintaining my life at that time. Because I was originally from like a village in Sri Lanka, I had to come to the capital for my higher education. So the boarding fees and everything was there. So that interaction with early clients, kind of gave me an insight into how the business world works. So when I got my first job, it was actually a company in the UK. I was hired as a software engineer. That company had basically like two parts, one software development and the other side of things were done in accounting. So when I started working there, I saw that they were kind of struggling to keep up with the time logs because the accounting side was things, the accounting side was billed based on the time they spent for client work, and that has to be absolutely precise to kind of do the billing. So no one asked me, but I thought that they could use a software to kind of manage this scenario rather than spending like an entire Friday to come up with these time logs and then figure out like which client has to bill how much. So I worked at home and I ended up building a system where they can, when they start working on something, they can just select what they're working on and for which client. And end of the month or end of the week, it'll automatically generate web reports where the management could download and just send to the client and the billing. So I presented it to our CEO when he was around, and that kind of really caught his eye. He was really happy about it. And that is the, I think, the turning point from for me from development to management, because I got an invitation to kind of join the management. I really hope he saw something in me that could drive that side of things, because how I interacted with the actual real world problem and my solution and how it really kind of fit the problem. And not only I got an invitation to join the management team, they actually used that product as one of their companies, and then they marketed it to other people in Sri Lanka and Europe. I think they did it for like, I don't know, 5, 6 years after me leaving there, even. Yeah, so that's the turning point from my fully technical side of things to manager. So from there onwards, I joined a project management position in another company and kept moving forward.
So yeah, that's a very interesting story. So as well, you're a person who've been not only working, I mean, you've got a lot of experience because before you started like engineering, later you became a tech leader, and then you even did the role of COO, right? So I'm not only like you did it in Asia, but you also did it in UK and Europe. So what was that? What keeps you sane from that? This, you know, all this innovation going on and difference of culture and technology in every part. I mean, even that now is global, but at that, I think it 17 years ago, it was a bit slower pace, you know.
That is true. Well, what kind of drives me is my kind of passion towards innovation and working with people. So if I give like a good example, probably my third job, I think. I joined a company which had offices in France and a few in Europe. So we got a rare opportunity to work on a tablet for kids in Africa. So basically it was called Kalasi at that time. And the idea was to kind of digitize the entire classroom. So we not only did a software kind of a thing, we were supposed to do the entire hardware, the operating system, and the applications that comes with it that would interconnect the parents, the teacher, and the kids in the classroom. So we had to kind of start from the drawing board, talk to manufacturers in China, understand all the specs and the limitations and how to build the tablet. And at the same time, we had to work on the software development side of things, all the application that goes in. And then came the challenging part. They wanted the operating system to be really limited. They did not obviously want did not want the kids to kind of, you know, play around in the tablet or do unnecessary things that's not supposed to be there. So we had to kind of redo the operating system that is an Android to be absolutely custom made. The challenge is, it's really hard to find someone in an environment like Sri Lanka who can do a custom Android operating system. So I worked with a couple of really skilled developers at that time, and I had to kind of learn from scratch how to do an operating system installation. So there's a special language in Google where you had to kind of build the OTA package, the over-the-air package, where the BIOS of the tablet before it goes to Android could understand the instructions on how to install this op special operating system and how to implement these limitations so the basic users will not be able to kind of, you know, use it in a different way. So things like that really kind of interest me. And I'm really happy that I was able to learn, do it. We went to Mobile World Congress in Barcelona. We presented the tablet to the general public. And that was like a really golden era of things where, you know, we kind of did things from scratch and we went to the Mobile World Congress with our product and presented it. So that's really something.
Whoa, that's a long journey. And I guess that what is the biggest lessons that you've experienced or you've learned with this change between, you know, you did tech, you did the leader, well, now you're a team leader as well as a product manager, a COO, like with technology, okay, like softwares that you're building these things. But what is the lesson learned from all that experience?
That's a really interesting question. So, if I could say just one thing, that would be that any leader on organization, project team, or anything really should be someone who knows what they are doing and could go to the ground level and get their hands dirty and work should the requirement arise. If I were to talk to anyone in Sri Lanka and ask, hey, can you do a custom operating system in a couple of months? I'm pretty sure the answer is going to be no. But we were able to sit together with a really elite set of developers at that time and then work with them to make sure the client requirement was done. And where there was a knowledge gap, I was happy to learn, do it myself, and you know, get things done. So I think that is the one thing that I could mention. Learn where you are, just learn learn what you're doing. That's it.
Yeah, they say that life is a journey and you just stop learning when you are there.
Yeah,
I
that is
heard that. I
true.
don't know who was that. I kind of didn't quote it exactly, but I know that it is the same like that. And I completely
Well,
agree with that too.
I agree.
So I'm kind of like, well, now you know all the AI theme, you know, there's so much noise, so much wound about all the things that's going to change with AI. So you as a person with a lot of experience with software and technology before the whole boom of AI, what is the takeaways from AI right now in what you do and how, the way that you lead in your workplace, what you do basically your work?
Right. So the AI boom actually came. I mean, I'm not going to say it's a surprise, but I would say it's a surprise in terms of the timeline. We knew it's going to happen, but personally, at least from my side, I did not think it would happen this soon. With the AI boom, I think organizations are looking differently into how they're going to get things done, especially 2025, 2026. You will see these changes being applied throughout organizations. Like if I take a simple example, Microsoft, I think, had about a layoff of about 6,000 of its employees. It's not solely because they are going to like be replaced by AI. That's not the case, but organizations are going to work differently. For example, instead of being replaced, they will look into reduction, where something took 10 people will now only require 5 people. So there's a compression of the workforce. So I believe that is where the AI is heading. And I think everyone, regardless of IT or, I don't know, accounting, admin, whatever, I think we will all feel this work compression in the future. So I think, yeah, I mean, we should all be ready to face it. I would recommend everyone to kind of educate themselves in how to use AI productively. We all know AI is there, but if you would ask anyone to do something with the AI in a very productive manner, I mean, there's a learning curve to it, right? I mean, everything has a learning curve. So go through that learning curve as soon as possible and yeah, be prepared for it.
Yeah, and now when we talk about the story, when the story, a bit of the, yeah, the background of the AI before or the before the boom, that people that were not in tech in that moment, we didn't even know, you know, like I haven't been over 17 years in this world, so for me it's kind of, well, it's kind of been almost just AI since the beginning. So what is the most human challenge you had to face AI in your workplace as a leader, you know?
With AI, well, as of now, I'm not going to see Just a quick clarification. Are you looking at before the AI boom or after that?
After.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you
So
for that's
recently,
a good one.
right? I would say the biggest challenge is getting organizations and clients to kind of trust AI. It's kind of surprising. Even recently, when we sometimes reach clients with AI products, they are skeptical. They are afraid of AI. They kind of doubt if their data should be even allowed in these platforms. They kind of feel this as like a black box. And like, you know, humans, all of us, are afraid of things that we don't know and we cannot explain. So I think there's a learning curve that has to be provided to, I think, all the employees to trust and to how to safely use AI. There's a safety aspect of it. You do not want to expose everything into some random AI product someone has came up with. You should always be aware of where the data is being stored, how your data will be manipulated. Is the AI is going to use the data you're providing to be retrained? So a lot of issues. And from the other side, there are ethical issues like, you know, what you expose to AI. Can you tell details about your clients or co-workers with names and everything? And what happens if someone hacks it, right? So all interesting problems. So I think those are the challenges we see from a human angle these days. So I assume as many new things that came to the world, with time, people will learn to work with it, embrace it, and love it. Until such time, I think as leaders, we need to make sure we provide necessary proper guidelines and awareness to co-workers as well as clients.
Yeah, that's a very kind of wise advice, I have to say, because I think that right now in the professional field, everybody, not everybody, but many people are kind of afraid of AI will take our jobs, you know, for example. So it's kind of like, why I should trust this? You know, why I want to give my skills to this kind of AI, you know, it's kind of interesting. So in your experience, what is the biggest misconception that people still have between AI and their, well, with, not even between, like AI in their daily lives? Like not just in the professional field, but as well in their daily lives, like in a normal setting.
I believe two things. Like from the professional side of things, I think people are terrified. One fine day, the company will come and say, "Hey, you've been replaced with an AI. So the new AI John is going to take on your work and take it forward." I don't think that would happen for a long, long time, if ever. As I mentioned earlier, there can be a job compression where employees' capabilities are enhanced with AI. So they are more efficient. They produce more work than they used to. So the company could feel, yeah, I mean, we only need 5 questions. Now we had 20, but only 5 people is enough. So that compression is there. But replacement, I really don't think that is something people should be afraid of. Instead, people should actually embrace this new technology and figure out how they can make themselves more efficient. So when they go into the next interviews, they should be talking about how they use AI in their work properly, ethically, to make their work better, do things more effectively and productively, and how they could learn new things where they would have usually missed or they didn't know. I mean, that's the whole point of having an assistant, right? To tell us that things that we don't know. I think that should be the angle. And from the other side, I think people are a little bit terrified about AI generating images and things that were not possible earlier. So there is a damage or impact on the perception of reality. What is real? What is not real? Is this video real? Is this photo real? People could start questioning everything. I think that's not a too bad thing. Again, people need to kind of figure out how they can work around it, how they can understand what is real, what is not real. There are ways to do that. So I think, again, there's a bit of a learning curve.
Yeah, definitely. I also found actually on this last weekend that there's kind of like a trailer of a movie, but it looks so real. And then a friend of mine was like, "No, this is AI." I'm like, "Are you sure?" And then I just look it up and like, "Oh my God, it's just like, you know, I'm actually all the time working with AI, so I kind of know kind of have a lot of knowledge about AI because I have to. It's kind of part of my what I do, right? So,
Of course.
but I saw that trailer. I was completely no, like, and then they said in the comments, they say that this is the AI. You know, they should make the whole movie. You know, and they don't have to be, they don't need people anymore. So it's kind of like, I feel like it's very interesting. It's the direction that we are going. You know, it's kind of interesting. I found
It
it
is
interesting
very
myself, but.
interesting, and it's nothing to be afraid of. And people saying we should replace 100% actors, it's going to be pretty tough because AI, one thing AI doesn't do is like have emotions. So if they have like a really emotional scene, the depth that a real actor could bring into that, it's not going to be there. So there will be like technologies like screen capture and things that they can use to kind of capture emotions, guide the AI in a proper way. But as you correctly said, we could have a lot of the set done in AI. So to save resources, speed up on the timeline, etc.
Yeah, it's
It's
so
interesting.
interesting. We are actually way, I think, in the best era, to be honest, for me at least. Okay, so you talk a lot that the way that you drive innovation, you make like a combination, right, between design, data, and technology. So would you mind sharing a story or a moment that you combine all of those things at the same time in your work? Workspace.
Right, so this happened about a couple of years ago. We were serving large tier one telecom operators in the APAC region at that time. And I don't know if you have heard, certain APAC countries still have feature phones, especially like, 5, 7 years ago. So they use these feature phones for everything, not only just messaging and calling, they use it for mobile money transactions. There are street vendors where you can give money after a hard day of work. Instead of going a long way to the bank, you can just give the street vendor, ask them to deposit, they can deposit. And they use something called USSD codes, where you might have seen like StarHash, something like that, right? So these codes are heavily used for telecom functionality. So these codes will take you to a menu and you can go through the functions in the menu and get services done. The problem is humans are required to remember all these codes. And if you have like a menu structure, if you want to go to the 10th menu, and there are like levels of menus, like on the first menu, you select option 5, second menu, fourth option, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If it's a cascading menu. If you're going to have to go to the 10th level, you have to keep on going from 1 to 10. That's how it is designed. So we came up with idea to incorporate AI at that time. This is prior to the AI boom, actually, if I were to say that term, to still use a machine learning language where people can actually type my bill or pay bill, something in like the spoken English. And we even supported the native language where they could use, type it in English, but in native terms that they use. And the system will automatically take them to the right menu. They did not have to spend time. They did not have to remember all the codes to kind of enter it. It is really efficient. So we were able to kind of create this product. We even presented it in a local award competition. We won one of the awards as well. And of course, deployed it to one of the telecoms. So that is kind of like how we had to think around the problem and bring in a really odd solution to kind of bridge that gap. And just to put things into perspective, they were kind of transferring about millions of money per month on that platform itself because there were a lot of people using these feature phones at that time. So the telecom was among their competitors. This particular, our client was like, people found it really used, handy. Of course, people were attracted to it. I think that's the whole point of, in a business, like, if you have a money platform that channels money, keep on growing it, attract people to it, make sure their platform is really efficient for people. So yeah, that's what we did. And that was a really success story.
Yeah, that's kind of a good job, actually, I would say, because
Thank
sounds kind of
you.
pre it's that's it's pretty complex, I have to say. It's not like a walk in the park, let me say.
Yes.
So, well, I kind of started wrapping up the interview. I would like to ask you something more kind of personal, maybe from what you've been engineer, then you've been at you're a product manager now, but you as well doing the, as we already talking in the beginning of the podcast, COO. So it's kind of not the most usual journey, I would say. So how has your view of innovation changed as you move closer to the executive table? Like you're now executive actually. So from being an engineer to where you are now, like I think it's impressive journey as well.
That's a good question. So when you reach to a point in your career where you try to manage innovation versus what is profitable, if I have to put it in a way, that becomes challenging because from one side, we really like innovative things. We want to do the best for the world. We want to keep the industry moving forward. And from the other side, we have to kind of play this game to see what kind of attracts most of the clients. So when it goes into enterprise level business, it's a bit hard to kind of go with a really odd product and say, hey, I have this innovative product. Do you want to buy it? It really doesn't work that way. How it works is a client would float an RFP, a request for proposal, or show of interest documentation where vendors are invited to kind of bid and compete with each other for that opportunity where we can serve the client and, of course, make a business. So that really limits our options as executives where we can do innovative things. Because there's a compliance list with the RFP that we need to tick. And even if you have 100 more ticks to put there, no one will care. It's just the 10 ticks that they're looking after will make the sale. So what we did was, I mean, that's a good example because when I was in Sri Lanka, we had a product called Self-Care for mobile telecoms. So you might have seen like pretty much most of the telecoms have like a self-care application. It's a common thing. We kind of pioneered it in Sri Lanka and we were able to grab 100% of the market share in Sri Lanka. So what we did was once we into a client with RFP, we kept prompting like suggestions to improve their business, cut down cost, and how they can grow their image in the general public. So for that, we provided features, suggestions, guidance. I think as executives, that is what we need to do. Go into a business, go to a client, rather than trying to do a huge sale at the beginning and then handing it over to the support team moving forward, work with the client. Make sure the client becomes successful over the year, be part of the success, and then earn your, rightful income. I think that is what most businesses should do rather than just do something, deploy, do implementation, done, fine. Now you go to the second team, they will look after you. There's a support team. Yeah, I think that mentality, I mean, if that can be changed and if companies work more with the clients, improving their products and the client, I think that's the way forward.
Well, I loved your that advice that you gave. Actually, I think it's very wise. I gave, be part of the success of the client. I think that's kind of the key of everything. Yes. So now, I would like to ask you something kind of, maybe it's a bit more personal, but I would like to know, because you are a person who obviously as executive, you have a lot of pressure, the role that you have, because you're a tech leader, right? So you lead a team and you obviously have your deadlines and your things. So I would like to ask you, where do you find your sense of clarity and purpose and to keep going, I mean, you can say, I don't know, most of people find in their families, other people do just find in the reward of the work itself. So what about you?
For me, it was pride of my work. So wherever I was, like as a developer or a manager, executive, wherever, whatever I did, I took pride of what I did. And I always wanted to be the best in that area. So I did not want to limit myself to what I do as in my job role. So as an executive, I make sure the teams were really good. introduce so many things to the teams, make sure their lives also moved forward. I paid attention, interest to where they are in their life. I tried my level best to understand where they want to go, what would help them as well. So it's to actually serve the community, serve the industry, keep moving forward. I actually ended up working with some universities as well, doing guest lecturing, doing career day lectures, like, you know, teaching the graduates on, like, you know, how to land their first job, how to be successful as an engineer, et cetera, et cetera. Did that for about a couple of years as well. So yeah, I think that bigger picture, making the successful bigger picture, is what drives me. And wherever I go, that's what I would try to do.
Yeah, that's a good answer. So yes, kind of like last question, like what you already gave a lot of advice on things, but I like to ask. I feel like it's a way for you to maybe share or express something that I didn't ask, or you would like to share, but I didn't ask for it. So if you would like to share something, it's optional and some and bonus of something that you did, a story, whatever, or advice again, or yeah. Feel free, basically.
Thank you for the opportunity. One thing that I often think about is, in a world where machines are getting smarter, what does it really mean to be human or a human employee? I have had experience with AI systems in telecom, fintech, and other large enterprise platforms. And one thing I can tell for sure is AI systems are brilliant in learning patterns. And we as humans are really good in breaking them, especially when the data doesn't cover the full story. So the real edge that we humans have over AI is not just to have creativity, but it is to have context, to have empathy, to have intuition, and all of that. AI is capable, I mean, it's absolutely capable on assisting on decision making. But it will not be able to understand the emotional weight behind a decision or even the long-term consequences of a choice made in the real world. If you're feeling like the AI is catching up, do keep in mind, this is still supposed to be our vision, our goals, our ethics that defines where this is going. This should not be seen as industry leaders as an opportunity to cut down staff or do reductions. So my message to all the industry leaders is that let's invest just as much as in human development as we do in machine intelligence. That is how we will make the most out of this partnership. Thank you.
Well, that's very, very beautiful. I think it's been perfect, that kind of get your quote there. Was great. So thank you very much. I enjoyed the interview very much. I get to know you a bit more as well. It was great. I really like what we talk about. So yeah, thank you, Samita. It was great.
And thanks, Flo, as well. And again, thank you very much for having me. I really did enjoy this time with you. And yeah, good luck with all the sessions you're doing.
Thanks for listening to the Humans in AI podcast. We are here to spotlight the people making AI more human, one story at a time. See you in the next episode.